fluctuations of the direction of the order parameter in systems with continuous symmetry in low dimensions. And so we, as we discussed last time, this is the fluctuations of the direction of the order parameter is what's going to be important in low dimensions where the critical temperature is much smaller than the mean field critical temperature, right? So in that case, the disordering of the long range order is precisely due to fluctuations of the order of the direction of the order parameter, which are the Goldstone modes, right? So these fluctuations have an energy cost which vanishes in the limit of long wavelength. Okay, so we have the nonlinear sigma model that describes that. That describes the Goldstone modes. It's 1 over t integral d dx. And then I have so grad and a dot grad and a. And so as I mentioned yesterday, we can use the fact that as dimensionality is going to approach 2, the critical temperature here, so Tc of d, is going to go to 0, right? So we can use Tc basically as a small parameter and set up a 2 plus epsilon expansion, okay? So 2 plus epsilon expansion in small deviations from the lower critical dimension 2. Okay? I will not go through the calculation, but we will just discuss the results that we get. Okay? So the result of this calculation is the RG flow equation for T, right? So the only coupling constant that characterizes nonlinear sigma model is T here. And so the flow equation that you get has a following form. It's dt dl is minus epsilon t. Okay. Plus n minus 2, where n is the number of components of this vector. Okay. Times k sub d. So k sub d is this constant, which we've already seen before. This is the area of the unit sphere in d dimensions divided by 2 pi to the d. So k sub d times t squared. Okay, and this is t that's been written in some dimensionless units. Doesn't matter. Okay, doesn't matter what the units are. So this is the flow equation. So let's analyze it, just as we did for the 4 minus epsilon expansion. So first of all, let's find the fixed points. So there are obviously 2 fixed points, right? There is a fixed point at 0, t star equals 0. Yeah. Sorry? Times lambda. Right, yeah. I think lambda, let me just check. It doesn't really matter because this is just a constant, but let me just double check this. It may be that, you know, I have absorbed lambda into that dimensionless T, okay? But let me just double check if I actually have this here. Lambda. Yeah, I probably don't have the nodes for that there, but maybe it's here. Sorry. K sub d. No, so here, you know, the Sorry for the inconsistency, but here case of D means this. So the lambda, the dependence on lambda has been absorbed into making this T dimensionless, okay? Okay, so there is this fixed point, right? And then the second one, which is proportional to epsilon, so T star is epsilon divided by K sub D times n minus 2. Okay, so there is obviously something funny that's happening when the number of components is equal to 2. And well, that's not an accident, that's physical. And we will talk about this later. So for now, let's just assume that n is greater than 2. Okay. Again, just in the same way as we did for 4 minus epsilon expansion, we can analyze the stability of those fixed points. And it turns out that this one is unstable always, while this one, this one is always stable, while this one is always unstable. Okay. This is stable. This is unstable. And so then the RG flow looks like this. So I have just a t-axis, right? I have the origin here, right? And then I have this non-trivial fixed point here, epsilon divided by k sub d n minus 2. And so this point is always unstable. So on this side of this fixed point, you always flow to infinite temperatures, while on this side you always flow to zero temperature. Okay. So then it's clear that this fixed point represents the critical point. Right. So this is the critical point. So this is just Tc, and Tc is proportional to epsilon. Precisely in agreement with the Merman-Wagner theorem, right? So if epsilon is non-zero, we are slightly above two dimensions. There is a finite critical temperature, but this critical temperature vanishes as epsilon is going to zero. Yeah.
You said that you absorb the lambda in T to make it dimensionless.
Right.
Why is there a linear term on the RG flow equation? Because as we saw, and you said before. For the RG flow equations, usually the linear term has the dimension of the quantity that you're trying to renormalize.
Right. Okay, so let's see what, that's a good question. Let's see what dimension of T here is, right? So I have, so this would give, this gives me minus D, right? And then I have plus 2 from the two gradients, plus 2, and then, so minus dimension of T, this has to be zero, so therefore dimension of T is 2 minus D, and that's precisely minus epsilon, right?
Shouldn't that be, so when you say 2 plus epsilon expansion, your epsilon still the
4
minus D, or this
is
another?
No, epsilon is D minus 2, right?
Okay.
So epsilon is supposed to be small. So the dimension of this T here is precisely correct. So why am I saying that? they've made it dimensionless. I mean, I guess all I'm saying is that let me just glance at my sorry about this. No, no, L is dimensionless, of course.
T is dimensionless. Of course, epsilon is dimensionless.
T prime. Okay, it's not really important, but just to not to sweep anything under the rug. Let me start from the recursion relation that I would get from this RG. So the recursion relation I would get is the following. So 1 over T prime, so that's the T after one step of RG, right, is going to be 1 over T plus 1 over T epsilon plus N minus 2 T lambda to the epsilon, and then K sub D delta L. So this lambda to the epsilon is the dimension full factor that I want to eliminate, basically, okay, by the redefinition of temperature. So just wanna see how exactly that works out here. So I get this, and then, so if I define now, let's say, let me call this T tilde. So T tilde is equal to T times lambda to the epsilon, and lambda is the cutoff, right? That's the 1 over A, right? So
can't you say, for example, epsilon is small, near 0, so lambda to the epsilon inside is 1?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I think that's the point, that since we are doing this to leading order in epsilon, right, that's exactly what we did actually for the in the 4 minus epsilon expansion, when we took all the coefficients, when we evaluated all the coefficients there in 4 dimensions. So here we are evaluating all the coefficients in 2 dimensions. Yeah, so I think that's the point. But anyway, let me not spend more time on that. I can guarantee you it's correct. So just work through that. So just take this recursion relation and rewrite this in differential form. But you are probably right. What you're saying is probably right. Yeah. Okay, so so again, so what this is saying is that this fixed point here is a critical point. On this side, we are flowing to infinite temperature. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Could you please repeat what you said about Tc going as epsilon and the connection of that with the background?
So this is what I mentioned yesterday. That so in systems with continuous symmetry, as we discussed, there is Merman-Wagner theorem, which is saying that in this case the critical temperature is going to zero as dimensionality is going to two. So there is no long range order in two dimensional systems with continuous symmetry at any finite temperature. Okay? So it means that Tc here is a function of D, is a function of dimensionality, has to vanish as D is going to two. So epsilon is precisely the deviation of dimensionality from two. And so Tc going as epsilon is consistent with Merman-Wagner theory. This just represents the disordered phase, right, or paramagnetic phase, where we are just under RG flowing to infinite temperature, right, or correspondingly zero correlation length, right. Here, this represents ferromagnetic phase or ordered phase where we are flowing to zero temperature. Okay. And so this is the critical point, right? Now, the interesting thing is what happens exactly at when D is equal to two. Okay. So let's now analyze this situation. So when D is equal to two, then epsilon is going to zero, right? And then we have dT dl is just equal to n minus two k sub d. Well, I can just replace this by k two, I guess. T squared, right? And the RG flow. So the non-trivial fixed point disappears. I only have now a fixed point at zero, right? And that fixed point is unstable now. Okay, so this corresponds precisely to the lack of phase transition at any finite temperature, lack of ordered phase. So if you deviate even infinitesimally from zero temperature, you are just flowing to infinite temperature under RG. Okay, so you are always in the disordered phase. Now, so very interestingly, this kind of RG flow is exactly the same as RG flow for Young-Mills theory in four dimensions, which basically describes interaction between quarks. Okay, so this property is what's called asymptotic freedom in the context of quantum chromodynamics. And you know, its physical meaning in that context is that quarks always. So the interaction between quarks, the strength of the interaction between quarks grows as the distance between them increases. Okay, so that's what, in that context, the increase of that coupling constant under RG means. Okay, so you know, people got Nobel Prize for this calculation in the context of quantum chromodynamics, but so it turns out very interestingly that. There are a lot of similarities between the Young-Mills gauge theory in four dimensions and nonlinear sigma model in two dimensions. Okay, so it's not just that their beta functions are the same, but there are a lot of other similarities which have to do with topology and yeah.
Here we're considering epsilon to be greater than zero, right?
Yeah.
What happens when I approach from d equals one to d equals two when epsilon is smaller than zero?
Well, I mean, so if dimensionality is less than two, if d equals one, then I mean it's always disordered, right?
However, in this case, the RG flow would flow up to this. The one that in this
well,
case,
this is not so the way that the calculation is the calculation this 2 plus epsilon expansion works, it's not really valid for epsilon less than zero. It's basically because it assumes that as a starting point that there is an ordered phase. Technically, basically you separate the components of N into component along the ordering direction and all the transverse components. So this simply would not work below two dimensions. Okay. So what I can do in two dimensions for N greater than two also. So if I solve this RG flow equation, which is somewhat non-trivial, so I will also skip those details, I can find the correlation length for this system as a function of temperature, right? So since the system is always disordered at any finite temperature, correlation length is always finite, right? However, it does diverge as the temperature approaches zero, because exactly at zero temperature, the system does order, right? Exactly at zero temperature, all we have to do is minimize the energy, right? And the energy is obviously minimized when n, the vector n, is just uniform, right? Uniform and along a particular direction. So if I solve that flow equation, I can actually find psi as a function of t. And so it has the following form. It's proportional to e to 2 pi times n minus 2 divided by t. So it diverges exponentially, basically it diverges as e to 1 over t as temperature is going to 0. So now the really interesting question is what happens when n is equal to 2, right? So clearly clearly something happens. So when n is equal to 2 in two dimensions, the beta function just vanishes. Okay, and it in fact can be shown that it vanishes to all orders in T. It vanishes exactly. Okay. So when d is equal to 2 for two component spins, the beta function, which is just the right hand side of this equation, vanishes, and that gives you a clue that something special must happen. So the case of two component spins is different. Okay, so let's see what happens in this case. So let's go back to our nonlinear sigma model, but let's explicitly assume that the spins are two component. So I can write my vector m in the following way as the x component plus the y component, right? And in this case, it's easy to choose parameterization of n, which explicitly solves this condition that n is a unit vector, right? I can simply choose an x to be a cosine of some angle and an y sine of that angle, right? I choose an x as a cosine of theta and y sine theta, then that condition is obviously automatically satisfied, right? N dot n is automatically equal to 1. So let me then rewrite the nonlinear sigma model in terms of this variable theta. Okay? Okay, so if I calculate the grad n dot grad n and sum over the components, what I'll get is so the gradient of an x is going to be you know, minus sine x d theta dx, right? Squared is going to be sine squared x d theta dx. Well, plus d theta dy. So sine squared theta grad theta squared, right? Plus cosine theta squared grad theta squared. So simply grad theta squared. Okay. And so then I get S of theta as 1 over 2t integral d2x of grad theta squared. And here it will be convenient to, you know, you remember that I've absorbed the coefficient here in the numerator into my definition of t. Here it will be convenient to restore it, and I will call this coefficient rho sub s. Okay. So this rho sub s just tells me, you know, how in a microscopic model how strongly the spins are interacting. Okay. Okay. So this looks like a very simple model, and naively, you know, this even looks exactly solvable, right? Because theta of x, so this is just a real field, right? So then this looks like just a Gaussian model. It's quadratic in theta, and therefore it seems like we can just solve it exactly. Okay, so let's pretend that we are naive, and we indeed think that, and let's calculate the correlation function of thetas. Okay. So to write it in this form, where I have one in terms of where I have one, right? I've absorbed basically this coefficient into t before, right? Because really, I mean, I have only one coupling constant, this ratio. But now it will be convenient to return to rho s. Okay? I mean, rho s is just proportional to, so in my original microscopic model, right, it has form like this, minus j sum over I and j, let's say where I and j are nearest neighbors, si dot sj, where si are two component spins. And so rho s is basically just proportional to j. Okay. So rho s is something that determines, you know, how strongly the spins are interacting in the underlying microscopic model. Okay. So let me try to calculate the correlation function g of x, and I'll define it in the following way as e to I theta of x, right? And then times e to minus I theta of 0. And I write it in this way because, you know, the x and y components of n, what I really want to calculate the correlation of are n's, right? And so since the x and y components of n are cosine of theta and sine of theta, I can write the correlation function of n's basically in this form, right? Where I'm just calculating the correlation function of the exponentials. It's just convenient for calculating it. Okay. So I mean, clearly it's going to behave the way it's supposed to behave, the way correlation function is supposed to behave, right? If theta of x and theta of 0 are just the same, right, so they're perfectly correlated, this is going to be equal to 1. While they are uncorrelated completely, this is going to be 0. because the average of just e to I theta, where theta is simply random, is zero. Okay, so what is this correlation function equal to? So it's 1 over z, where z is the partition function, integral over all configurations of the field theta, e to I theta of x minus theta of 0, e to minus s of theta, okay? Since s is just quadratic in theta, actually calculating this average is very simple. It's just a Gaussian integral, and it can be shown. I'm not going to prove that, but you know it can be proven in two steps. Basically, you could do it in a tutorial probably. That this is just equal to e to minus 1/2 theta of x minus theta of 0 squared average. So basically what it means is that when you are calculating an average like that, and the variable theta obeys Gaussian distribution, which it does, right? That's what Gaussian distribution means, that it's quadratic in theta, then so in the cumulant expansion here, you only the second cumulant does not vanish. All the higher cumulants just vanish identically. Okay. Okay. So let me now evaluate this average here. So I can write this theta of x minus theta of 0 squared average in the following way. So this is going to be theta squared of x plus theta squared of 0 minus 2 theta of x times theta of 0. Now, due to translational symmetry, right, since every point is equivalent to every other point, clearly the average of theta squared of x is going to be the same as average of theta squared of 0. And so then I can write this in the following way, as twice average of theta squared of x minus theta of x times theta of 0, right? And so to evaluate this, let me use Fourier transform. So let me rewrite this now in Fourier space. So this is going to be 2. And then I'll have integral from 0 to lambda, where lambda is, as usual, proportional to 1 over a, the lattice constant, dk. 2 pi to the d, right? I have theta, average of theta of k, theta minus k. Here from this factor, I'll just get 1, while here I will get minus e to I k dot x, right? Is this clear? And then, so this average is just, as usual, this is just the coefficient of modulus of theta squared of k in this action when I Fourier transform that, right? Well, the inverse coefficient, I mean. So this is going to be twice integral from 0 to lambda dk 2 pi to the d, right? And then so that coefficient is 2t divided by rho s, right? And then 1 over k squared, 1 minus e to I k dot x, okay? And so this is, of course, d. I can explicitly set d equals 2. So this is just a two-dimensional integral, d to k to pi squared. So this integral is easily evaluated. Let me skip the evaluation here, right? So the way you do it is, so you can use spherical coordinates with the z-axis along the, or with the, let's say, y-axis along the direction of x, right? So then the result of this calculation is going to be the following, that so this average is equal to t divided by pi rho s, and then I have log of x divided by a. So the one subtlety here is that you do have to take into account the fact that, so it's not really subtlety, that a just comes from lambda. Yeah, so it's not really a subtlety. Okay? So this correlation function is just proportional to log of x divided by a, and the coefficient is proportional to t. Okay?
Excuse me.
Yeah. So lambda is just proportional to 1 over a, right? So this is the high momentum cutoff. Okay, so now if I plug this back in here, right, so I get g of x is equal to e, so to minus t divided by 2 pi rho s log of x divided by a, right? So the correlation function just goes as 1 over x to t divided by 2 pi rho s, right? So here what you should recall is the this general form of the correlation function at the critical point, right? Which goes as 1 over x d minus 2 plus eta, right? So someone was asking last time, yesterday, what's going to happen when d is equal to 2. Well, what's going to happen is that eta is going to remain, okay? And so clearly this then has the meaning of the anomalous dimension. But the important thing here is that this anomalous dimension is not universal, okay? It actually depends on t and rho s, okay? So t divided by 2 pi rho s, okay? And so then, in fact, you know, what this looks like is that what we have is an infinite line of different fixed points for every temperature of different critical points where the anomalous dimension is just proportional to temperature. Yeah.
So we know that we have some scaling relations for the critical exponents, right? So the fact
right.
that one of these depends on t will imply that the other ones will depend on t.
Yeah.
If I'm trying to, I'm thinking in terms of the universality classes, but does that mean that the critical exponents depend on temperature so that I switch from it?
Well, no. So this is not really, you know, this, it's not really a transition, right?
Okay.
So this is just a line. So we'll see later that the RG flow for this model looks like you have a line of fixed points, okay, which simply means that the RG flows, you know, end on the on one of the lines, right? So basically, if you derive RG flow for this parameter rho s, right, then so the RG flows end on this line, right? And so the corresponding anomalous dimension is just proportional to t, right? But this it doesn't correspond to any transition in that case. Okay, this is just a phase which is characterized by this kind of correlation function.
Another thing, we said that this Mermin-Wigner theorem says that there's no long range order
right.
at finite temperature.
Right.
So this is a case where I have zero temperature where I can have long range order right. within the Boltzmann models.
So in this case, you know, so if you have long range order, the correlation function would be constant, right?
Yeah.
If I define it this way.
Yeah, I mean, in T0, the correlation function is just one, but.
Yeah, so it's just a constant. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the meaning of this correlation function now. So clearly, this means that at any finite temperature, there is no long range order. So the correlation function does decay to zero as x is going to infinity, right? Long range order would mean that the correlation function is just a constant at infinity, right? Because the way I've defined here, this correlation function, I did not subtract, I did not define it in this way. Let's say phi of x, phi of 0 minus phi of x, phi of 0, where my phi is e to the I theta, right? I did not subtract that average squared. So in that case, in the long range ordered phase, the correlation function just remains constant in the limit x going to infinity, right? Every spin is correlated with every other spin, even if they are infinitely far, far away from each other. So here, the correlation function does decay to zero, but it decays in a scale invariant way. Right? There is no, the correlation length is infinite. Okay, so. This. So g of x does go to zero as x is going to infinity, but correlation length is always infinite, right? So correlation function just decays algebraically, which would be the case normally only at the critical point, okay? But here it's true. It seems like this is true always, okay? And just the exponent depends on temperature. So it does decay faster as the temperature increases, but it still decays in an algebraic fashion with the correlation function being infinite, okay, at any temperature. So everything is in agreement with the Mermin-Wigner theorem. There is no long-range order at any finite temperature. However, so if you just think about this, this cannot be right, okay? And the reason is that, you know, certainly if I take temperature to be extremely large, meaning, let's just look at the microscopic model. So if I take the temperature to be very much larger than J, right, then the fact that those spins are interacting should not matter, right? And the spins will just fluctuate independently, which means that certainly in the limit of very high temperature, there must be a finite correlation length, which in fact approaches, you know, just the lattice constant as temperature is going to infinity. So this result that we got, that correlation length is always infinite, cannot possibly be right, you know, just based on basic physical considerations. So certainly at t that's much larger than j or much larger than rho s, psi must be finite. Okay? And so there must be a critical temperature, Tc, at which the correlation function changes from this. So there must be a finite Tc at which g of x changes from so this form e to so 1 over x nu of t to something like e to x over xi divided by x to nu of t. Okay? E to minus x over xi, of course. Okay? Yeah?
I got a little confused. So we said that the theorem from yesterday said that in t less than 2, less than or equal to 2,
mm-hmm.
no order theta and non zero.
Right.
So here we have an infinite correlation then. Doesn't that suggest that there is an order? I mean,
no, so the order phase means that, you know, the order phase means that I have a non-zero expectation value of e to I theta of x, right? That would mean that this correlation function is going to a constant as x is going to infinity, the constant being just this squared. Right, so let me call this m, right? So then ordered phase would imply that g of x is approaching m squared as x is going to infinity. That's what long-range order means, right? So here, obviously, this is not happening. Correlation function vanishes, but it does not vanish fast enough, basically, at high temperatures. So at high temperatures, it must vanish exponentially because there must be, because, you know, at infinite temperature, certainly you'll just have independently fluctuating spins. Yeah.
There's something that's still not clear to me. So do you define a correlation function just as the average of this product?
Right.
So you're saying that the individual averages are zero.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But that's on the assumption that the fluctuations that I'm considering are.
No, I'm not assuming anything, you know. I just define correlation function in this way. Right?
Right.
And I got what I got.
Yeah, but however,
so,
with the action that we have here came from an approximation from the Heisenberg model, right?
Right.
And there we assume somehow that the fluctuations are, they have zero average. Right.
No, we did not assume anything, you know. So it's just a matter of definition of the correlation function. And before I define correlation function in this way by subtracting, you know, the average squared. I just wanted to have the correlation function to have the same behavior on both sides of the transition, right? So the correlation length just diverges on both sides of the transition. Here. I mean, it's not going to happen anyway. Correlation function is going to be different on the two sides of the transition. And so there is no reason to define it differently. And then the order parameter is also zero on both sides of the transition. Okay. So anyway, the point here is that there must be a phase transition where the nature of the correlation function just changes, right? It's still a phase transition because, you know, this clearly means that the correlation function behaves non-analytically, right? Correlation lengths for t greater than tc is finite, while it's strictly strictly infinite here, right? So it's still a non-analytic behavior, which means that the system for t less than tc and for t greater than tc is in a different phase. However, it's a phase transition that's different completely from the phase transitions we've discussed so far, which could be characterized by an order parameter. Okay? So this type of phase transition cannot be characterized by another parameter. It's characterized by different kind of correlations. Okay? So this is a phase transition. Without an order parameter, okay? And this, you know, presents a challenge because, you know, basically everything we have done so far kind of assumed the existence of an order parameter, right? What was dependent on the existence of an order parameter. So the question is, how do we describe such a transition? And what does it mean, really?
How does this analysis not contradict the Mermin-Wigner theorem?
Well, so the Mermin-Wigner theorem just says that M has to be zero at any finite temperature. The order parameter has to be zero, and it is zero. It does not say, however, that there can be no phase transition. It just says that there cannot be a phase transition with an order parameter. Okay? Okay, so now, but the first question is what exactly went wrong in this calculation, right? It seems like, you know, this is just a straightforward calculation, and I just get this result. I cannot possibly get a correlation function that decays exponentially from there. And so what's wrong is kind of subtle, right? What's wrong here is that I've assumed that this theta is just a real variable, right? That's defined from minus to plus infinity. That's what it means that, you know, I have a Gaussian integral. So in particular, this, you know, passing from here to here, that's where I basically assume that theta is just a real variable that goes from minus to plus infinity. However, so if we recall what theta actually is, right? Theta is simply an angle that gives me the direction of the vector m. So clearly, you know, physically, theta is just defined from 0 to 2 pi, right? It does make sense to define it from minus to plus infinity. Okay. But so what this means in more physical terms is the following. Let me erase this. Oh, no, let me leave this. Yes. And so it's not just, you know, it's not just a mathematical issue. So we've missed very important physics by assuming that theta is just a real variable. And this physics is the existence of vortices, okay? Since theta is defined from 0 to 2 pi only, what this means is that there are vortex like configurations of n, right, which look like this, right? So I have let's say some point in space, and then n, or equivalent to theta, winds around this point by an integer multiple of 2 pi. Okay. So in this case, it winds by 1 unit of 2 pi. Sorry?
Is this supposed to be obvious? That it follows?
Well, so just okay. So the just think in terms of n and not theta. N is a unit vector, right? And so there can clearly be configurations of n which have this shape, right? So once I rewrite everything in terms of theta, and if I forget the fact that theta equals 0 and theta equals 2 pi is the same thing, what this means is that I am basically neglecting the possibility of such configurations. That's the point. Okay.
So where, at what point, are these are all defined at the same point, or just in a small circle around this point?
No, so just it's a good question actually. So what happens in particular near such a point is that you can see that the gradient, you know, since the phase has to wind by a finite amount on going around this point, right? Clearly, the gradient of theta becomes ill-defined, right? It becomes infinitely large because I can make a very, very tiny loop around this point of very small circumference, but theta still has to go from 0 to 2 pi around that loop. So that implies that the gradient of theta near such point becomes infinitely large. And so that continuum limit is not well defined in that case.
Okay, so this is like a source for the field of theta.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it's like a point charge, exactly. So it's like a point source of field theta, yeah.
So when we make this assumption that theta can go from negative, theta is just a real, are we sort of denying this to be a topological feature?
Well, yeah. I mean, we are basically, you know, forgetting the fact that theta is just a parameterization of n, right? That theta equals 2 pi or any integer multiple of 2 pi has the same meaning as theta equals to 0. Right? We are just forgetting about that fact.
If we let theta be complex, that's the same as varying rho, right?
If you let theta be complex, I mean, I can add a. If I let theta be complex, but so where are you going with that? Even if I assume that that's true.
Actually, if we were to do that, wouldn't we not then have this problem of a finite interval for a complex?
No, but what would be the point of that? I mean, theta. Originally, what we have is this unit vector. So I introduce theta in order to take into account the fact that that n is a unit vector, right? That was the point for, you know, so n has two components. So superficially, I have two variables, an x and an y. But then I have a constraint that n has to be a unit vector. Therefore, an x and an y actually not independent variables, right? I have an x equals plus minus square root of 1 minus n y squared. So I really have just one variable plus this complicated constraint, but I can solve this constraint conveniently using this variable theta. That was the whole point of introducing that variable. So making it complex, I don't know. I don't know what the point would be.
So in the case of just because calculating the action, I mean, calculating the average, then that integral over theta goes between 0 and 2 pi, but I have to take the winding number of the whole interval between minus.
So if you just did the integral from 0 to 2 pi, everything would be fine.
Right.
But it's difficult to do that. Okay. Okay, anyway, so let's put a seed with the vortices. So basically, it turns out that this transition for this transition from the algebraic correlations, power law correlations, to exponentially decaying correlations has to do with precisely such configurations of the field N that we have neglected. Okay, so it's those degrees of freedom, the vortices, the vortex configurations of N that drive this transition, and we'll see exactly how. Okay, so the first thing here is that obviously, if I want to really take into account the possibility of such configurations, I have to abandon for now this continuum limit, right? Because clearly, the gradient of theta is, as we discussed, is ill-defined near such a vortex, right? Near a vortex core. So let's go back to the lattice model then. So I have H is minus J. And so here, for simplicity, I will assume in order to, you know, to have a single constant that describes interactions between the spins, I'll assume that the interactions are only between nearest neighbor spins. So that this is what this IJ in angular brackets means. It means that the interaction is restricted to be short range, okay? Only between the nearest neighbor spins, Si dot Sj, right? And I can use the same parameterization for S, right? I can call Si of x cosine theta I, and Si y I will call sine theta I, right? Then it's easy to see that this can be rewritten in the following way as minus j sum over I and j cosine of theta I minus theta j, right? So what does a vortex look like in this lattice model, right? So in this case, there is no singularity, right? So I have my square lattice in two dimensions. And a vortex simply means that I have a particular plaquette, square plaquette of this square lattice, around which if I take any loop which encloses this plaquette on the lattice, the theta, the variable theta winds by 2 pi, or by generally an integer multiple of 2 pi. So an analog of this picture would be something like this. So I have spins everywhere winding by 2 pi, right? So, you know, going back to the continuum limit in this case, if I want to go back to the continuum limit, so what I do is I assume that this difference, theta I minus theta j, is small, right? So theta changes slowly on the scale of the lattice spacing. In this case, I can just expand cosine theta I minus theta j as 1 minus 1 half theta I minus theta j squared, right? So I get then h is a constant plus j over 2 sum over I and j theta I minus theta j squared. And then theta I minus theta j is nothing but discrete representation of a derivative of theta, right? So in continuum limit, this becomes gradient of theta squared. So in continuum limit, this goes to j over 2 d2x grad theta squared. But so again, the point is that I can do that even in the presence of vortex, I can take continuum limit if I'm far away from the vortex core, right? Because there the theta still changes slowly. However, near the vortex core, so in particular on this plaquette, clearly the change of theta between nearest neighbor sites is large. So I cannot just represent the difference of theta as derivative. Right? So continuum limit breaks down near vortex core, okay? And so what's important about vortices is that they are topological objects in the following sense. So imagine I have this vortex, right? So if I take any loop infinitely, even infinitely far away from the vortex core, as long as this loop encloses the vortex core, right, then, so if I take an integral around this loop, and imagine that I take that loop really far away from the vortex core, so I can take continuum limit, I can represent the difference between thetas on neighboring sites as just the gradient. So then integral around this loop of gradient of theta dot dl is always equal to 2 pi times an integer. Okay? So in the case of this vortex, integer is 1, right? Theta winds by 2 pi. And so the presence of the vortex here can be detected even infinitely far away from the vortex. As long as you're evaluating this integral, the circulation of gradient of theta around the loop which encloses this the vortex core. Yeah.
So one question. If I look at the limit of high temperature, then I should have a disordered phase, right? So
right.
The appearance of these vortices, I mean, the probability of having a vortex should be small, right?
No, it's actually the other way.
It's very large?
It's very large, yeah.
Okay.
So if you have a lot of vortices, that precisely means that, the direction of the spin in a given point is ill-defined, because it can fluctuate a lot, right? If I have, if I always have a lot of vortices on average.
However, in the limit of zero temperature, it's true that there are no vortices at all, right?
Well, at exactly zero temperature, there are no vortices. The theta is just uniform. So once you raise temperature, there is always a probability. But so as we will see, what you have at finite temperature is that so that the vortices are bound to vortices with opposite n. So you can call them anti-vortices. So for example, vortex with n equals 1 is going to be always close to a vortex with n minus 1. So this is a vortex anti-vortex pair. So if you have a vortex anti-vortex pair, plus 1 and minus 1, then so if you look, if you calculate the circulation around the loop that encloses both of them, then the circulation is 0. There's a total n, the net n, is going to be 0, right? So and as you increase temperature, the average distance between the vortices gets larger and larger until eventually they unbind from each other. So that's what this transition is going to look like.
Anti-vortex is just pointing inwards?
Yeah, it's just same winding, but in the opposite direction.
So
theta is, as I'm going, let's say, counterclockwise, theta is here, the way I drew it, that theta is rotating, counterclockwise as well. But I could draw it in the opposite way, theta rotating clockwise as I'm going counterclockwise. So that would be vortex with negative circulation, negative n.
So why is this a important feature for D equals 2? Why these things don't arise at higher dimensions?
Well, no. So if I have a model with n equals 2, with two component spins, right, vortices can arise in higher dimensions, right? Let's say if I have three-dimensional system, right? In this case, vortex would not be a point. The vortex core would not be a point. It would be a line, right? I can have a line around which the spins are winding. But in this case, they just don't play an important role, right? So because in this case, in three dimensions, there is long-range order. And so the phase transition is just a regular transition where the average value of the spin vanishes. Okay, they simply don't play a role in this case. For d equals 2, what's special is that the order parameter is always 0. But then there is this physics of vortices that becomes important. I mean, another thing is that let's say in three dimensions, vortex cores are really not points but lines. Right? Here, vortex cores are points, and so as we will see, vortices can be thought of as particles, basically. And that so this is only true in two dimensions. So vortices behave as charged particles. So that's why they are important in this case.
Can you not do the analogous thing in three dimensions? Surfaces?
Well, yeah. So if you have a model with three components of spins, right? There are also topological configurations of the order parameter in this case, which look like hedgehogs. So it's a point where you know. So if you take a radius vector from this point to any other point, the spins always point along the radius vector. So it's like looks exactly like a hedgehog, right? I mean, any section of the hedgehog through the origin would look like this, but you would, it's gonna be in three dimensions, right? But this, topological defects just do not play such an important role in, when you have more than two components.
Is it so this that we have this 2 pi n when we go around the loop?
Right.
Does that follow from here, or is that something that is true in physical systems?
This just follows from the fact that, you know, theta and then theta plus 2 pi times an integer is the same thing, right? So if you go back. So if I take any loop, right, if I go back to the same point, theta can only differ by an integer multiple of 2 pi.
I'm
returning to the same point. I'm returning to the same theta. So along this loop, right, the net change of theta can be only by an integer multiple of 2 pi. It just follows from the fact that theta is really only defined from 0 to 2.
But is n specified by the defect?
Yeah, n is specified by the particular vortex you can have, right? So you can have a vortex with n equals 1, but you can have a vortex with any n, right? So a vortex with n equals 2 would mean that theta winds by 4 pi if I go around this loop. So it winds faster.
So. What if I took this section that you've drawn and just put that down in a lattice where everything else was all aligned in the same direction? That would not be a vortex?
So if you took this and then, well, that's the thing, that it's impossible, right? Once you have, when you have this configuration, right, it's going to have an effect infinitely far away from this point,
okay.
Right? There is no way to make this kind of thing local, right? Even if I take a loop which is infinitely far away from this point, however you distort the spins there, this integral will still be 2 pi. There's no way to get rid of it. That's why it's topological, basically. So the fact that, you know, these configurations are characterized by integers, and there is no way to smoothly eliminate an integer by any smooth transformation of the of thetas, right? That's why, you know, these are called topological defects, okay? Because they're characterized by those integer numbers.
In this case, your left is just a plane without a point.
Well, you know, so in, you know, there is no singularity in the once I define this on a lattice, right? So if you try to define a vortex on a continuous plane, then well, you can do it, but there is this singular behavior exactly at this point. So in this sense, yeah, it's going to be a plane without this point. But once you define it on a lattice, on every, you know, your degrees of freedom are defined on sites of the lattice. And so as far as the sites of the lattice are concerned, everything is fine. There is no singularity, right? That's why I went back to the lattice from continuum. Yes.
One other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Here we're already dealing with a limit near t equals 0, right? We're making this analysis.
Everything is true.
It will be for t different from zero, but I mean, the extrapolation that we made as t goes to zero and this stuff, shouldn't that be treated with a quantum Hamiltonian instead of this classical?
Well, no, I'm explicitly assuming that all the degrees of freedom are classical. So those spins are just explicitly classical variables. I mean, the similar physics exists for quantum spins, but in that case, it actually exists in one lower spatial dimension, because, you know, for quantum spins, for quantum systems, the time plays the role of extra dimension. So in this case, for 1D spin quantum spin systems with this type of symmetry, you get a similar kind of transition. Okay, so let's just continue a little bit on this. So these are, again, so the vortices are topological defects. For this reason, that they are characterized by an integer number, right, which represents winding of the phase around any loop surrounding the vortex. And so once you put a vortex in the system, it's absolutely impossible to get rid of it, right? Because to remove a vortex, what I would have to do is kind of unwind an infinite number of spins, right? Which would cost an infinite energy in the limit of the system size going to infinity. Right. So what would I have to do to remove, let's say, this vortex? Right. So if I make this cut on the lattice, right, then on this side of the cart, nothing really drastic has to be done. I just slightly rotate the spins, let's say, to the up direction. But here, right, I'd have to rotate this spin all the way upwards, but I'd have to rotate the neighboring spin all the way up in the opposite direction. And this costs a huge energy of order J times the length of this cut, which is proportional to the size of the system. And if I take that side of the system to infinity, if I take thermodynamic limit, then the energy cost of removing a vortex is going to be proportional to the size of the system, okay? So such a topological defect is energetically impossible to remove, okay? So let me do the following. To understand how this transition happens, let's calculate first the energy of a single vortex. So if I imagine I have a single vortex in the system, let's calculate its energy. So let's calculate energy of a single vortex with winding number n, right? So since this continuum approximation breaks down only near the vortex core, and the vortex itself is an infinitely large object, to calculate the energy of a vortex, I can actually forget about this fact that continuum approximation breaks down near the vortex core. Okay, I can just use the continuum version of this Hamiltonian, just remembering that it breaks down, you know, in some finite region around the vortex core. But since the vortex the size is infinite, it's not going to matter. Okay? So I can just say that the energy of this system is going to be J over 2 integral d to x gradient theta squared, right? And I have to minimize, right, to find first the vortex configuration that minimizes the energy, I have to minimize this energy with a constraint that for any loop surrounding the vortex core, the circulation has to be 2 pi times m, right? So I have to minimize h with constraint that integral of the gradient of theta times dl is equal to 2 pi m. And let me, for in concreteness, put the vortex core at the origin, right? So we are going to minimize this energy and look for the corresponding solution, assuming that there is a vortex at the origin with winding number n. Okay, so how do I minimize this? I have to calculate the variation of h with respect to theta, right? So this is equal to j over 2 integral d to x, right? And then I get twice, grad delta theta times grad theta, right? So if I integrate this by parts in the usual way, right, I can put all the gradients here. So this is equal to minus j over 2 integral, and this 2 is canceled by this 2, so just minus j integral d to x, right, delta theta times the Laplacian of theta, so grad squared of theta. And so this has to be equal to 0. So which means that I have to solve a Laplace equation for theta, but with that constraint. Okay. So I get an equation, grad squared theta is equal to 0, with the constraint that this integral of grad theta dl for any loop enclosing the origin has to be equal to 2 pi m. So this solution is in fact very simple. So the solution that satisfies those conditions is theta is equal to m times phi, where phi is a polar angle in polar coordinates, right? So if I have x and y, this is my 2D plane, then this is the radius vector to any point, then I have, you know, r and phi in polar coordinates, and so this phi is the polar angle. Okay. But I mean, this is the phi direction, but so this is the angle. Okay, so clearly the circulation is satisfied, and the Laplace equation is also satisfied. Okay, so then the gradient of theta is just equal to, so clearly, you know, the gradient of theta is going to be directed along phi, right? So then I have the gradient is equal to just n phi hat, the unit vector in the phi direction, divided by r. Right? This is just a gradient in polar coordinates, right? So then you can see that this condition is satisfied. Just take the loop to be a circle of radius r, right? Okay, so now I can plug this back into here and calculate the energy, right? So let me just calculate the energy and I will finish. So the energy of a vortex is an equal to J over 2. So integral D to X, right? N squared divided by R squared. So I'm going to have J over 2 integral from 0 to 2 pi D phi. And then integral, and so here I have to be careful with the limits, right? If I just take the limit, lower limit of this integral to be 0, then I will get an infinite result, okay? And that's just a consequence of the fact that I cannot use this continuum approximation near the vortex core, which is located at the origin. So here I'll substitute something that's of order of the lattice constant, A, okay? From A to, and then the upper limit is going to be the system size, which will actually diverge in the upper limit as well, okay? And then n squared here. And then I have just integral over r, 1 divided by r, okay? What I get is pi j n squared and then log of L divided by A, okay? So basically the energy of a vortex is actually infinite in the thermodynamic limit, but so it goes as log of the system size, okay? Question?
Is there something that is not clear to me? We're considering configurations of the field that have vortices because we made this, I mean, we're in a path integral formalism, kind of, right? Where I have to take into account all the configurations of the field. However, if I see the lattice model,
right,
why should I expect from that lattice model to have this type of behavior?
We will see why, basically. You can say that, okay, the energy of a vortex is infinite, so why would it even appear? Right? That's a legitimate question, indeed, you know, this is why at zero temperature, vortices don't appear. Right? But at finite temperature, right, what we have to minimize is not the energy, but the free energy, which contains, and the free energy is E minus TS, right? So it contains the entropy there, right? And then the entropy is proportional basically to the number of ways you can place a vortex in the lattice, which is also infinite. And so at high enough temperature, that entropic piece can overpower the energy. Okay, so that's what happens, basically. Okay? Okay, so we will see how that happens tomorrow.